south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
All right, let's start out today with an email that's bound to take us on some interesting detours. This is from longtime listener Clara. She says, "Dear Johnny, speaking of haters, I used to get so angry at your show, I would scream at you through my iPad. But that was a long time ago, and you've grown on me. I guess you could say before COVID, I was partially woke, but I'm sure unwoke now." She said, "What I wanted to talk to you about today is do-gooders and the newest stupid American craze called volunteer tourism. On that subject, I'm sort of an expert. I've done do-gooder tours in Haiti, Honduras, and Bolivia. They used to be completely organized by church groups, but now this thing called volunteer tourism has popped up for people who don't belong to an organized church group who regularly do feel-good trips. And so you feel left out of the feel-good experience movement. So this volunteer tourism thing is for people who want a piece of that feel-good action, but don't belong to any particular church or denomination that offers such trips. Let me start out by painting a picture for you that on the surface seems so right, but is very wrong. Imagine a busload of tourists coming into a school, disrupting a class to play with a group of disadvantaged children, hold babies, give them candy and gifts, make them stop whatever they're doing for the moment, and sort of put themselves on display for people they've never even met before. Would this ever happen in Canada or the USA? Could a busload of do-gooders pull up in front of a school and walk right in and say, 'Hey, we're here to play with your kids, get photo ops, and hand out free goodies'? No, I don't think so. If that happened in Canada or the States, the principal would call the cops. It seems only first world people with way too much have a savior complex. I know, I was and sort of still am one of them. As for me, right out of college with a useless degree in psychology, I wanted to travel, help people who grew up with less than I had. This, coming from a girl who never wanted to do dishes or take out the trash, it was a surprise to my parents, of course, that they suddenly had a do-gooder daughter. They thought our young girl, our precious entitled baby who got a brand new car as a high school graduation present who never wanted to serve her family, she actually wants to go to an S-hole country and help her more disadvantaged neighbors. They thought something's wrong with this picture, but I went anyway. If nothing else, I'd stay out of trouble, and my parents thought it would widen my worldly experience, and it did. I went on the trip, saw true poverty, and I was deeply impacted by what I saw. I came back, really moved, trying to tell others how many poor people I saved for that week of my life, and I would cry when I told them. Every time I saw a poor person on the street or on TV, from then on, I relived part of my week-long experience. I felt I was different. I had a spiritual connection that few other Americans of my age ever had. And I went back for more. Yes, three times. I thought what I did was valuable and that the people I helped and did services for and the kids I hugged and played games with needed my help, needed my time, and needed my non-existent yet all-knowing first world expertise. But those three experiences, along with my Peace Corps service, developed in me a firm belief that short-term volunteer tourism is just a feel-good but eye-opening learning experience, but nothing more. It took three trips, though, for me to learn that our efforts wasted materials and took jobs away from individuals who could have been paid to do the work properly and been amply compensated for their work with less than half of our eating expenses for the week. Though I know I'll get a lot of flack for saying this, but the services provided during those types of experiences do not aid the communities in which our groups were working. Building houses, painting orphanages, building fuel-efficient stoves, constructing campsites, and conducting daycare are taking jobs away from community members who depend on those jobs daily to provide that daily small amount of income for their family. Just one day without that family's small bit of income will negatively affect that family, not just for that day, but for the week, maybe the whole month. Yes, it's true, those service projects leave those who participate with a sense of well-being, feelings of positive impact, and of success and accomplishment. I know that feeling well. I felt it right after my first trip. It's what pushed me to keep coming back for more. I'll never forget it. We spent our time and efforts mixing concrete to refurbish a charity compound, yet our cement mixing was shoddy and incorrect. It was just not effective in accomplishing the needs of the site. But what did we know? Our efforts wasted materials and took jobs away from individuals who could have been paid to do the work properly and knew how to do the work for the conditions. None of us in that group had ever mixed cement before. The only mixing experience I ever had was mixing Pillsbury cookie dough. But none of us at the time ever gave one thought to the fact that building a house, painting an orphanage, building a fuel-efficient stove, constructing a campsite, conducting daycare experiences, etc., etc. Though great and happy communal experiences for us do-gooders, we were actively taking jobs away from community members. Then she says, one of the most interesting things I observed about those service trips from my own experience and from coordinating one for others was the big disparity in expectations and outcomes for all of us do-gooder participants. Groups come wanting to serve a community and leave feeling they were most productive painting a classroom or playing with children. That's because they can immediately see the impact of their work, be it a colorful classroom or smiling children. But painting a classroom and playing with kids doesn't actually do anything except make a room look pretty or introduce gringo games into the regular rotation of local kids' games. It's work, all right, but the kind of work that does nothing to improve the conditions of the local people. At the end of our week or two-week-long do-gooder trips, they pass out evaluation surveys for our groups. That in itself is an endorphin and serotonin-boosting experience. Just one problem. In looking over those forms, you'll see something strange, that almost everyone found the projects they enjoyed most and viewed as the most valuable were those which had the smallest impact in the long run. Painting happy kids on murals, having a sing-along, teaching an English class. Sounds nice, good, and fulfilling, right? But think of this. What if some foreign Spanish do-gooders came into a Philadelphia grade school, went into a sixth-grade classroom, and taught a one-hour Spanish class for just 1 week, and then they left? A gallant effort, but I guarantee, in a month, they'll have forgotten everything. Though a few of us do-gooders, after the end of the week, became slightly aware of the activities which did not go well or as planned, either because they were outdoor activities and the weather failed us, or because local community organizations that were supposed to be there didn't show up, whether because of mañana time or they just didn't want to help us because they knew, in the end, it wouldn't do much. Surely most local community groups have gone through the same drill over and over again with each new do-gooder group's arrival. But what did we know? We had poor people to save. And for people who say that donations are the answer to an effective do-gooder trip, people just don't realize donations, be they monetary or tangible, create a dependence on outside sources and take away opportunities for industry locally to develop or pre-existing services to be used. On top of that, bringing over donations or school supplies, clothing, or money and handing them out a la carte with no specific program or final aid in mind can have negative effects on the community, particularly on long-term do-gooder volunteers living in the community, who then become bombarded with demands for more stuff, more pencils, more shirts, more free lunches. It's not that those communities lack the things most commonly donated. It's that the people in those communities then start prioritizing their own purchases based on what free stuff they get. Poverty is the problem, not the lack of shoes and pencils. Giving away donations rarely corrects the problem. Instead, it compounds it and creates a dependence on foreign visitors and that outside aid. I found out from my experience so far that to really serve a poor community and meet their needs, you have to build relationships and understand the problems and wants of a community. That means not staying down there for a week or a month, but for years. And who's got time to do that? I really think, instead of a do-gooder group coming down for a week or two with one semi-professional person managing the whole show, keeping everyone busy, but in reality giving them pointless jobs, at least in the eyes of the community or local organizations. That kind of traditional do-gooder formula and giveaways are not the answers. Locals must be trained in professional and technical skills that can be used in the future when the do-gooders have gone. But that rarely happens. Positive impact on a community is not building a jungle gym in the schoolyard, making children smile, nor painting nice murals in classrooms. All right, then, Claire says, Johnny, did you know that in 2021, the average cost for a volunteer to go on one of those do-gooder trips for a week or two was $4,000 to $5,000 per trip, about 2 years' salary for the average Latin American. The other and perhaps more important issue, she says, is that so many of us volunteers don't even know what we're doing. We never did any physical manual labor work in our own lives. We never had to. But we also know that putting one of these trips down on our resumes once we graduate from college will help us get jobs at home. Looks good on that resume. But our inexperience undermines the initiatives of whatever projects we're supposed to be building once we arrive in that third world country. Many of our first attempts at mixing cement, laying block, or putting on a roof ended in disaster with a complete teardown and redo. Most of us never even held a hammer before. In the end, the locals were 10 times better and faster at doing it, but we were down there to make our mark, so we rarely gave them the chance. While we were working, though, the local people were all smiles, of course, and very eager to watch a bunch of gringos doing things, and very forgiving when we screwed up. Though I've often wondered if they were laughing at us inside. What their dinner conversation was like with the family when they got back home. The phrase, clueless gringo, crosses your mind. So, Johnny, there you have it. Those are my experiences with the dark side of do-gooderism. Signed, Claire from Philadelphia. Well, Claire, thanks for that. And it's good to know you don't hate me anymore. Not like you did in the early years of this show anyway, right? Though I have to admit, I do find it funny that the haters keep listening. Takes 1 second to turn the dial, you know, or swipe left. Anyway, there you have it, from the horse's mouth, or the do-gooder's mouth. And now an email from Colin, Manchester, UK. He says, Dear Johnny, you talk about national health care in Latin America and how medieval and dysfunctional it is compared to first world health care models. Well, I say bullocks. We've got our own version of medieval national health here in the UK. As you well know, Johnny, the world considers the UK the poster child or model for successful first world national health care. After all, we were the first modern country to have it. You've heard that before, right, Mr. Johnny? But what the media is not telling you is that there's 6 million on the waiting list for social health care in the UK. Yes, 6 million people waiting and waiting and waiting to get some kind of national healthcare treatment done. The government says for years, NHS, that's National Healthcare Services, has faced shortages of staff and resources, forcing long waits for people who need care. That's what they always say, a shortage of doctors, nurses, and healthcare professionals. Why do you think that is? It's because no one wants to work for the National Healthcare Service, mostly because it's a thankless job and it does not pay as well as private healthcare. As far as the 6 million on the waiting list, here's the breakdown. Fully 24,000 patients have been waiting for more than 2 years just to get seen by a doctor. And it's not just people with minor healthcare concerns who are left waiting. Over 60% of emergency room patients have waited more than 4 hours to see a physician. Only heart attacks, bullet wounds, and strokes will get you to the front of the queue. Anything else? Broken bones, accidents, neck trauma? The majority wait over 4 hours before they ever see a physician. Then there's the case of people who've had urgent cancer screenings. More than a third, more than 33% of people in that situation must wait over a month to even get the results of a screening. For those unfortunate patients who are diagnosed with cancer, 38% or more than a third had to wait at least 2 months to get their very first cancer treatment, despite receiving an urgent referral. I'm bringing all this up, Johnny, because it seems every American I run into is just dead set on wanting the U.S. government to start a national health care program like ours. I say, be careful what you wish for. All right, Colin, thanks for that. Here's my opinion. Take it or leave it. I think the idea of national health care is great. Yeah, cut out all the fat, the middlemen. That means the insurance companies, all the useless paper pushers, etc., etc. However, the sad fact is that everything government touches turns to shit. Just take a walk through the VA, Social Services, or the Social Security Administration building near you. It's nothing but slugs and pinheads on parade. So in reality, I don't know what's worse, leaving it in the hands of private insurance companies and big pharma like it is right now, or handing it over to the slugs, retards, pinheads, and swindlers in government. Of course, we had a nice big taste of it back in 2013 with Obamacare. If you recall, in the early days when they're setting up the computer software for it, they dumped $500 million, that's $500 million, into the Obamacare website. It was a spectacular failure. It all goes back to central planning and how horribly that works. Just look at the Soviet Union. By the way, I don't know if you know this. Few people do. But on the debut of the Obamacare insurance sign-up website, remember, there have been hundreds of IT people working on that website since 2010. They had 3 whole years to work it out. It was such a failure that on the first day, when 2.5 million people went on that site, only 6 people in the entire country got it to work well enough to select coverage on the day it launched in 2013. That's 6 out of 2.5 million visitors. You'd have a better shot at winning the lottery. And yet, 3 out of 4 people in the U.S. want to put the entire healthcare system in the hands of those retarded idiots. Oh, and there's thousands of stories of Canadians coming to the United States to get work done because they've got huge waiting lists up there, too. But you knew that already, right? In fact, every Canadian that's come to one of my Expat Insider seminars has pulled me aside and told me some horrific stories about their own or their family or people they know who've had terrible experiences with the Canadian healthcare system. Though they always admit it's great for checkups and routine stuff. In other words, if you're not sick or having any problems, it's just fine. Is there something ass backwards about that, or is it just me? But then again, the world is just filled with people overweight and out of shape. No need to remind anyone about that. Obviously, they're the ones weighing down the system, no pun intended. But I have to say, when I read about that teenager who fell to his death from a 430-foot-high ride at the Icon theme park in Orlando, Florida, I'm sure you caught that headline. I thought there had to be something more to this, because when you go on those big rides, they have that all-encompassing support bar that they drop down over your shoulders and chest before they start the ride. And as they slide it down and it's secured, there's a solid click. And sure enough, a couple days later, in the news, the small print, of course, it said the maximum weight for that ride was 287 pounds. And Tyree Sampson, the teenager, was 340 pounds, or 53 pounds over the limit. What do you make of that? Now, I'm not fat shaming here, because that's pretty much what I would weigh if I lived on Jupiter. By the way, as far as the amusement parks and rides here in Latin America, a long time ago, maybe 5-6 years ago, I spoke about how Latin American cities and towns are just loaded with amusement parks. Almost all of them traveling shows, very, very few permanent ones. I've been on quite a few rides myself, but I don't go on rides that are either heavily rusted out or fabricated before the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. I have my standards, you know. But hey, let's face it, we all go on rides to get a thrill. And if that thrill maybe includes not coming out alive, some people like that kind of danger too. If you ever been into parachuting, hang gliding, or scuba diving, you know that feeling. You must know those sports are hundreds of times more dangerous than hopping on a Ferris wheel. By the way, did you know that the Ferris wheel was named after George Washington Ferris? He invented it for the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. Oh, and did you know that before around 1950, almost all really big amusement park rides were made out of wood in both the U.S. and everywhere else? Talk about blind trust and taking your life in your own hands. And if you're wondering, people down here in Latin America get hurt on amusement park rides all the time. Yep, and some die too. But people still come to get on the rides because the show must go on. Speaking of a good and really cool show, lately I've been seeing ads and posters showing that Cirque du Soleil is touring through Latin America. They do that every so often, and I understand Cirque du Soleil has many different troupes going around the world at any given time. And there are lots of first world bands and theatrical presentations coming through Latin America all the time, too. Just to reinforce the fact, if you live in or anywhere near a big Latin American city, you'll almost never be hurting for world-class entertainment. And, of course, really brain-numbing crap entertainment, too. All right, now let's switch gears a bit and talk about hiring the locals here in Latin America. Whether you've got a brick-and-mortar business or you're just hiring a cleaning lady or maintenance guy, there are some pitfalls and traps that you must be made aware of. Now, as for me, I'd never want to have a brick-and-mortar business or hire a cleaning lady or maintenance guy on the books, that is, in a Latin American country that's on the gringo tourist trail. What I'm going to go through now is the employment law for a country that's well on the gringo tourist trail, that's Ecuador. It's pretty much the same for other places on the gringo tourist trail, including Mexico, Costa Rica, Belize, etc. However, do remember, if you're off the gringo tourist trail in countries like Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Bolivia, Peru, and a half dozen others, when you're off the tourist trail, the local employment laws are much more lenient. So anyway, now you're going to hear why I'd never want to hire help in Ecuador or anywhere else on the gringo tourist trail. And so if you're going to live on the tourist trail and want to have a business, I highly suggest you have an internet business. Then you won't have to hire any locals and conform to some of these idiotic rules. Anyway, here goes. Let's say you want to open a small business in Cuenca, Ecuador. It used to be simple and easy, but not anymore. Not since the gringos have piled in. And as such, the government has created tough labor laws, and they enforce them like never before. All right, let's talk salary. Let's say you agree to pay your new full-time employee the base salary of $425 a month. That's minimum wage required by law. Now, again, remember, we're talking on the gringo tourist trail. Off the trail, minimum wage is more like $300 to $350 a month. Anyway, back in Ecuador, where you'll pay a $425 a month minimum wage, understand you are really obliged to pay not $425 a month, but $595 a month. How'd that happen? Well, the law requires you to pay an additional 11.15% each month to the Social Security, called IESS. You must pay a month's extra salary for Christmas, a month's extra salary for family holidays, and 15 days of vacation. And after your employee has been with you for a year or more, you must pay another 8.33% into Social Security, called the Fondo de Reserva. So broken out by the month, it's $425 for base salary, $47.38 for Social Security, $35.41 for that Christmas month, $35.41 for that family holiday thing, $17.68 for 15 days of paid vacation, and when your employee hits 1 year of service, you'll pay an extra $35.40 a month for that Fondo de Reserva we were talking about. Then there's overtime and weekend holiday pay and pay for nighttime work, which works out to 150% of a day's wage for overtime, 200% for weekend holiday pay, and nighttime work, 125% extra. By the way, overtime is called hora suplementaria, and holiday weekend pay is called hora extraordinaria, and nighttime work is called horas nocturnas. All right, let's talk about firing. Let's say your new hire doesn't work out, regularly comes late to work, doesn't do a good job, on the phone all the time. Well, you could be stuck with this person forever if you fail to make him sign a contract from the get-go. But let's say you've got this signed contract, and you get that from your lawyer, by the way. You just don't create one on the spot by yourself. You got to get your lawyer involved, or it won't be legal. Anyway, suppose you've got that signed contract, and it only becomes clear after that probation period of 90 days that you got yourself a real bad employee, a lemon. The only way to get rid of him after that 90-day period without paying stiff penalties is to go to court. But you'll probably lose, because if you can't make your case and the standards are high and much in favor of the employee, not the rich gringo, you'll have to compensate your employee by paying an indemnization equal to 3 months' basic salary, also pay a dismissal penalty equal to 25% of his annual salary, and you'll pay an extra amount to an account for vacation pay and other expenses. Now, let's say your employee quits after 3 months with you. Well, you'll still have to compensate with indemnization or 3 months' pay. If your employee has worked for more than 3 years, you'll also be liable for a year's indemnization. Yep, an extra year's salary. That itself being $5,000 or more. Yikes. Now, here's the part that you really won't believe. If your business is lucky enough to make a profit, you are required by law in Ecuador to share 15% of the profits with your employees. If you take a loss, though, it's on you. But none of this takes into account the hefty cost of hiring women who could become pregnant or disabled persons or long-term employees. Sure, you want to help them and look out for them if they're good employees, of course. That's why many a long-term gringo and expat would rather hire a guy. Consider this. If your employee gets pregnant, You can't fire her because she can sue you and get her job back, or she can sue you and receive 12 months of basic salary from you. Again, that'll be about $5,000 or more. While she's pregnant and still working for you, you must pay 3 months of maternity leave, and when she returns to work, reduce her hours to 6 hours a day for the next 12 months so she can nurse. Now, if by chance you have a disabled employee and you have to let him go, you have to pay 18 monthly basic salaries to him, not 12. If you one day reach a place where your star employee is coming up on 25 years of service, you're looking at an onerous pension liability if you don't fire him well before that. We won't even get into it. So maybe you think you'll get around all this expense and red tape by hiring an independent contractor to do the work you need. Nope, the law is clear. If you provide a regular schedule, detailed duties, etc., provide equipment and materials or training, you have an employee on your hands, and you'll have to follow all those rules and payouts previously mentioned. There's one final thing to think about when opening a business and having local employees, and it's a big one. What if you do all the work to get things set up right and your worker steals your ideas or steals from you or your clients? It happens all the time, of course. It's not right, but what are you going to do to protect yourself? You get a non-compete clause in your employee contract. Violating this non-compete clause can cost the offender a lot of money. So you have to have a clear-cut contract with that clause. Your lawyer will know about that. If you have more than just a small business, you should also consider having a clear-cut contract with your clients who might think to continue business with your worker who might be selling the same thing on the side later on. In summary, you need 3 contracts from day one. A contract indefinito for the worker, the non-compete clause, and the client contract. You might also insist that the parties sign the contract at your lawyer's office. Bottom line, go ahead with your dreams. Open your legit business, but make sure you can afford it. So there you have it, the basic labor rules for Latin American countries on the Gringo Tourist Trail. It's a hell of a lot different when you're off, believe me. How's that? You might be wondering, well, for starters, I've lived off the Gringo Tourist Trail for around 30 years now, and I've had gardeners and cleaning ladies, mostly full-time, and I've never had an employment contract with any of them. Though I've had to fire a few in, some have stolen from me, I've never been sued or taken to labor court. Oh, and one more thing, doesn't matter if you're on or off the Gringo Tourist Trail, if an employee steals from you, it's best to just fire them, let them go, don't take them to court, because for one, they haven't got anything, so you won't be able to get reimbursed, and two, if you want revenge or you want to get even, it's not worth it either. It's a waste of time. Because chances are they won't show up in court and or just disappear.
You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos. No Spanish language.